The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
Now, one of the reasons why Americans voted for President Donald Trump was that they hoped that his business acumen would deal with the economic ills, such as the accelerating U.S. national debt. This is what he said back in 2016.
You know, we're at $18 trillion now. We're soon going to be at $20 trillion. According to the economists, who I'm not big believers in, but nevertheless, this is what they're saying, that $24 trillion, we're very close. That's the point of no return. $24 trillion. We will be there soon. That's when we become Greece. That's when we become a country that's unsalvageable. And we're going to be there very soon.
That's what he said. We'll become Greece and we'll be there very soon. That was when the debt was at $18 trillion. It's now not at $24 or $26 or $28 trillion. It's at $40 trillion. And to talk about all of this, how the U.S. economy is faring under this administration, I'm joined by Brad W. Setzer, who's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Brad, good morning and welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Now, will you parse that for us? It was going to be a disaster if it went up beyond the 26 trillion mark. It's at 40. And you're not Greece.
We're not Greece. That was not Donald J. Trump's best analogy. There are 1,000 reasons why the Greece analogy doesn't apply. You know, you could have also played a clip when Donald Trump says he's the king of debt. He was not exactly renowned during his time as a businessman for either avoiding debt or avoiding bankruptcy. That said, the U.S. has too big a fiscal deficit. 6% of GDP is too big. It implies a debt that will continue to grow. The U.S. should take steps to bring that 6% of GDP fiscal deficit down. But the level of debt, it's high, but it's not catastrophic.
You mentioned that it is bound to accelerate, and one of the reasons why it is accelerating is that the cost of servicing the debt at the moment is somewhere above 13% of the annual budget, and that's just too high.
It is rising. Interest rates are rising. We benefited in the U.S., many countries in Europe. We suffered from a weak recovery from the global financial crisis, from the European financial crisis. But one of the side effects was a long period of low interest rates. That long period of low interest rates is over. That means the cost of servicing a big stock of debt is going up. It's several percentage points of U.S. GDP. And for a country that doesn't collect much tax, you're right, that's putting a lot of pressure on the rest of the budget if we weren't just borrowing it. And it's also making it harder for the U.S. to finance the build-out of all the data centers because they're now competing. The hyperscalers, the Googles, the Amazons are competing with the federal government for long-term financing.
How does that work? I mean, you've got these private companies, much supported by the administration. The administration, although they are getting a little bit nervous about what AI can do, and the politically the data centers are not at all popular with voters for both parties. So they are supportive of data centers and AI and all the rest of it, and yet they're in competition for borrowing. It seems strange.
It is strange.
It's a paradox.
It's a paradox. What can they do? Well, they can either keep competing. We're both trying to borrow long-term funds, the U.S. government and our biggest companies, in which case we'll either crowd out other forms of borrowing in our economy or we're going to pull in more money from the rest of the world. Some mix of the two. Secretary Bessent is trying to take some of the pressure off the U.S. bond market by shortening the time period which the U.S. government borrows. So basically borrow less 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, leave a little bit more space for the hyperscalers to borrow in those tenors.
So normally, you know, if you borrow long term, you can get a better rate. If you're at the mercy of the markets if you're borrowing short term.
You're at the mercy of the markets. Any sudden change in interest rates if it's an upward increase in interest rates, would lead the cost of debt to spiral up. And because the stock is big, it spirals up a lot faster. This gets all technical. I used to work at the U.S. Treasury. But, you know, the stock of short-term Treasury bills, the stuff that has to roll over and be refinanced every year, is heading towards 30% of U.S. GDP. You just do the math. When interest rates change, your interest cost moves real fast. So that, to me, is the biggest risk associated with this level of debt.
So is it possible for any administration to actually tackle the overall national debt? Just politically, it's very difficult to do the kind of things that you need to do to get that debt down.
Look, getting the debt down is probably an unrealistic goal. Keeping the debt from rising relative to our economy is an important goal.
This is the idea that the rising tide lifts all boats.
Or actually the rising tide puts all of the coastal lowlands at risk. I don't know quite what the metaphor is. Yeah. But you don't generally want a debt to GDP ratio that is always going up.
Yeah.
That probably takes a fiscal adjustment of 2% of U.S. GDP. If we're not willing to cut defense and, you know, we're fighting couple of wars, we're out of missile interceptors, you can certainly make an argument that this is going to be a difficult time to cut defense. You either have to pretty severely cut various forms of social spending, or you have to raise tax. I think the one thing you can say about the U.S. is that relative to our peers, we don't collect a lot of tax.
No.
So there is scope, in my view. You do have to have some discipline on the spending side. But I think in the end of the day, you're going to have to raise tax. And yes, that's not popular.
Now, it's...
Trump did find one tax he likes. It's called the tariff. Yeah. I'm not sure you all love that.
Yeah. I was coming to that because, I mean, we have now the trade war, which is going on between Canada and the United States. It seems, you treat your friends worse than you treat your enemies.
And we treat our closest neighbors, with whom we actually have a relatively healthy trade relationship, worse than we're currently treating China.
And
it doesn't make any sense.
It's a symbiotic relationship. I mean, what's good for Canada is good for the United States and vice versa. The trade goes back and forth across the border all the time and had been doing so under NAFTA and then the subsequent Trump agreement fairly seamlessly, and everyone was relatively happy with it.
There's always someone who's unhappy. Wisconsin dairy farmers never liked Canada's supply management. Well, you know, that's a modest, what the people in the trade world call an irritant. Bottom line, Canada was selling us a lot of oil that our Midwestern refiners need, and they were selling it to us at a discount because they didn't have pipelines to take it to the coast. That's the kind of deal Donald J. Trump should like. We're getting the oil safely, securely, and at a discount. Canada was the largest market for our manufactured exports, or among them. It is certainly one of the few markets for our manufacturers where we have a surplus in manufacturing. So if you're Donald Trump, you're getting the oil at a discount. You want to revive America's manufacturing. We're running a manufacturing surplus with Canada. This is a personal vendetta. It is not driven by economics.
So what's the personal element of it? Who is he trying to get at? Because Carney is a newbie, really, in relative terms. He treated Trudeau like a little boy. And Trudeau behaved a bit like a little boy, a bit subservient to Donald Trump bending the knee. Carney doesn't bend the knee. I mean, he's a man of a CV that is really very serious. This is a heavy hitter.
Well, there's a rumor that while Trudeau was bending the knee, he winked at Melania, and that's what got Trump a little upset the first time. I think that's a scurrilous rumor.
Could not possibly be true.
Could no. Look, Trudeau, a liberal, rubbed Donald Trump the wrong way. Carney rubs Donald Trump the wrong way. I mean, he's also from the liberal side of this political spectrum because he's a bit too academic, a bit too much of a professor, a bit too good at articulating some of the difficulties and contradictions in Donald Trump's agenda. And frankly, President Trump never really found a good way to walk back his quip that Canada should be the 51st state. And then he got real upset when Canada, Carney won the election on this, to be clear. did not bend the knee. They responded to U.S. tariffs with some tariffs of their own. And in Trump's worldview, you were supposed to take our tariffs and reduce your tariffs. That was what was needed to equalize trade after a long period of unfair trade. And, you know, first of all, the trade with Canada wasn't actually unfair. It was under an agreement that Trump in his first term had negotiated and that most Americans thought was working just fine. But when Trump, when Carney and some of the provinces retaliated, that sort of stuck in Trump's throat.
You know, people are concerned that Trump, he gets advice but doesn't listen to it. But sometimes he doesn't have the people around him to give him the right advice. And I don't mean the correct advice that he wants to hear. I mean the kind of advice that is fact-based rather than opinion-based or trying to please him-based. And that is an issue, isn't it, that the president doesn't educate himself as he should in taking that advice?
Look, I think President Trump gets the advice on trade that he wants. And
they tell him what he wants to hear.
Yeah. And President Trump, on trade, not on so many other issues, actually has pretty strong beliefs of his own. So I don't think you can attribute this to bad advice.
But that idea of a tariff not being a tax on the American people, which it is, and a Canadian tariff on American goods is a tax on the Canadian people. I mean, that's the way it works. And we all.
I mean, I think in his heart of heart, Trump knows that. He just won't admit it. He likes tariffs. He doesn't want to admit he's raising taxes on the American people. A large number of his economic advisors over time have made that exact argument to him. Gary Cohn, his first-term National Economic Council advisor, apparently had long, dragged-out debates with him. He understands it. He just is not going to give you that ground.
Now, the world is inextricably interlinked everywhere. I mean, whether it's China or the European Union, Canada, the United States. But what's going on with the yen, I'm trying to understand, and how that will impact on the United States, how what happens to the yen makes the United States vulnerable. I mean, is it about the amount of U.S. bonds that Japan owns, and if they decided to unload them, that would be a vulnerability for America?
I wouldn't exaggerate how important Japan is to the financing of the U.S. fiscal deficit. It is true that Japan, holds the largest quantity of U.S. treasuries. The European custodial centers, the UK, Ireland, Belgium, Luxembourg, collectively hold two times as much as Japan. Japan's holdings haven't been growing. I think the U.S. is worried about a couple of different things. One is that the yen really is weak. It is back at its levels, adjusted for inflation, of the 1960s, during the Vietnam War. Crazy weak. And that does impact some of the auto trade.
Okay, but I'm wondering, would Trump not just say, if the yen is very weak and therefore Japanese cars might be cheap, just tariff them?
You know? Oh, he's already done that. I think Secretary Bessent is really running this, and Secretary Bessent probably doesn't want to disrupt the deal and tempt Trump to go with higher tariffs every time the yen falls. So I think Secretary Bessent is trying to manage his boss a little bit. And then, yes, there is a bit of a concern. It's a strange concern, but the concern would be that if Japan feels like its currency is under too much pressure, and if it's not getting any help from the U.S., it might end up selling more of its bonds. And at the margin, and I'll emphasize at the margin, that might increase the U.S. cost of funds.
Now, what about Scott Bessent, a man regarded by some as one of the few adults in the room in the Oval Office when a cabinet meeting takes place? But then he is forced to talk about D-Day and what the United States will do to Iran. And this might involve literally collapsing the global banking system. Now, Scott Bessent is never going to do that. And the Iranians in their responses are saying, really? You're going to collapse the global banking system? Oh, no, you're not, Mr. Bessent. So is he enthralled to Trump to the point that he has to kind of make a fool of himself saying things like that?
My personal view is that you shouldn't do an analogy to D-Day unless you're actually willing to do a D-Day.
Yeah.
The analogy, to my mind, is inappropriate because American troops are not putting their lives at risk storming the beaches of Iran. It was inaccurate because it turns out the U.S. was not willing to take even modest steps to make it more difficult for China, for India, for Turkey to continue their current trade with Iran. This looks like feckless rhetoric and an attempt to, you know, in the same way that Trump said at various points in time he was going to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age, and then he didn't. If you threaten massive sanctions and you don't do them, it undermines your credibility. It was a rhetorical error, policy error, in my view.
I shall borrow that phrase, if you don't mind, feckless rhetoric. Could be very, very convenient. Brad W. Setzer, a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations in the USA. Thank you very much for joining us on the program.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.